All right, we start our first Kabbalah class. It's an area of teaching. I haven't touched this topic at all in 7 years. You know, I know you're familiar with the idea that you're not supposed to learn Kabbalah before the age of 40. So where does that come from? So it comes from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Bein Arba'im Labina. The age of 40 is an age of understanding. And the truth is, who says that applies to Kabbalah? Well, we have to see what Kabbalah is. But who says that applies to Kabbalah? Where does that come from? So, one of the histories behind it is that in the 1760s, when the Frankists, I don't know if you know who the Frankists were. Frankists were a derivative of the Shabtai Tzvi movement. Very strange group, very odd group. We had one of the world's authorities in the Frankist movement speak here last year. Pavlo Machiko from Hebrew University. And the Frankists, one of the things they did to win favor with the Catholic, with the church, is they went and said the blood libels are true. They really happened. And they also then converted to Catholicism, and they said they're doing it because there's no more need for mitzvahs anymore. They reached the level of nishmasa de nishmasa, the soul of the soul. There's no need for the physical guf anymore, the mitzvahs. We're done with that period. Similar to what Shabtai Tzvi did when he went over to Islam and things such as that. Nishmasa de nishmasa. At that point, the Vad Arba Artzos, the four corners, so to speak, the four areas of Poland that got together to meet the Gedolei Torah, decided that no one should be touching this Kabbalah before 40 because of the dangers that it led to, them thinking nishmasa de nishmasa. Did that really take hold in every Jewish community, and how far do they mean it to go, and what type of Kabbalah were they speaking about? That's subject to debate. Rav Moshe Cordovero says the age of 20 is the age of starting Kabbalah, and anyone who knew anything in Kabbalah who has what to say about Kabbalah, there's no doubt they began at a much earlier age than 40. Ramban was writing about Kabbalah way before the age of 40. So we usually assume the Masorah is that we follow Rav Moshe Cordovero's number, which is the age of 20. But the one condition is that you've studied a little bit beforehand, a little prop, you studied a little something beforehand. You know, yes.
But since it says Bina Yisera,
women should be able to study earlier, huh?
Right. You anticipated.
All right. So, Kabbalah. I start off with a story. And by the way, the style of the shir, what is it? History? Is it Parsha? Is it heavy Kabbalah? What's it going to be? I'll answer you right now. The shir is going to be a little of each. I'm going to explore some of the history, the intellectual history of what's Kabbalah, what's it all about. We're going to go into some of the deeper teachings, the primary themes and ideas of the Zohar and the Kabbalah. And I'll also try to do as much as possible a little bit connected to the Parsha and areas like that. So we'll be doing, this is a Kabbalah class, I think, on all levels, an intellectual history of Kabbalah. It's a spiritual journey for us as well in Kabbalah. I'm taking it that way for myself as I study through it. And also it opens you up, and I'll explain why, but learning this Kabbalah opens you up to new worlds of Hasidic Torah. For that alone, this class is Dayenu. I'm going to expose you to some Kabbalistic concepts that now once you have them, you can get beyond the first level of Hasidic Divrei Torah that you might hear, Vort here, Vort there. You can now take it a step beyond and really begin to grasp things that are at a higher level of Hasidus, and what many people call Kabbalah. So I begin with the story of the Zitichover. The Zitichover was one of the great Hasidic Rebbes. He was in my 50 great list when we did that first 2 years I was here. And the Zitichover was brilliant, and his opinions, he was always disagreeing with a lot of different Hasidic groups. He was famous for his battles with the Balatanya and Lubavitch Hasidim. Lubavitch Hasidim, when they heard the Zitichover was coming to town, they wanted to put signs all over, you know, putting him in Cherem and telling him to go home. And the Balatanya, who disagreed with everything of the Zitichover, told his Hasidim, you be very careful how you treat the Zitichover. Very, very careful. A very holy person, a brilliant person. And someone once went to the Zitichover, a Litvak, and said, you know, what did your Baal Shem Tov do? Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidus. What did your Baal Shem Tov do, right? What did he add? We already had these deep ideas already. Didn't Rav Shimon Bar Yochai already apparently compose the Zohar? We have to see if that what that means, if that's true. But didn't Rav Shimon Bar Yochai come up with these ideas already? What did he add? And the Arizal, fine. What did Baal Shem Tov do so much? Do you make you Hasidim make a big deal of your Baal Shem Tov? So the Zidit Shavar said, I'll tell you a story. And this is the essence of why we can even have a shir like this here. The Zidit Shavar said that once upon a time, there was a fellow who came back from a trip in Shul. There was a fellow who came and took a seat here. There should be there's another chair there, and we're good. There's a chair there, good. The Zidit Shavar told a story like this. That there was a fellow who came back from Shul. He was away on vacation, 200 miles off the coast of South America somewhere, some strange island. And that day when you took a trip, everyone wants to hear about it at Shalosh Shudas. They say, come, say a few words here at Shalosh Shudas about what you saw. And he gets up there at Shalosh Shudas and he says, I was on this faraway island and there I saw a bird that looks like a human being. And everyone was like, oh my goodness, wow, 2 years later, someone else from the shul decides to go to this faraway island. And they have, of course, when he gets back, a big Shalosh Shudas for him to tell what he's... By the way, we're going to explore also why Shalosh Shudas is such a big deal in Hasidism. We have to look at that also. That's Kabbalistic as well. So he comes back and they say, what'd you see there on the island? He says, I saw the bird that the first guy saw. I saw the bird that Shimon saw. So they say, but new Yitzchak, what'd you see? So he said, I saw over there that the bird didn't just look like a human. It's a half bird, half human. It's a hybrid. Like, wow, everyone's in shock. They're mesmerized. 2 years later, from the shul, Yisrael goes off on a trip. He takes the same trip, and he goes out there, and they host the big Shalosh Shudas for him. And all of a sudden, they're waiting to hear what he has to say, Shalosh Shudas, and from under the table, he pulls up a cage. Says the Zidit Shavar, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai discovered something many years ago, but we didn't understand what he saw. Many years later came the Arizal. We're going to go through the detailed history later. Many years later came the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, and defined, clarified what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai saw, but it was still out of our reach. Came the Baal Shem Tov and said, enough is enough. I'm bringing the bird to the people. I'm bringing the bird to the people. That, says the Zidit Shavar, is what the Baal Shem Tov did different than Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and the Arizal. That's what the Baal Shem Tov did different. Okay? So that is essentially why we're able to study Kabbalah here today. Because the bird has been brought to the people. It's no longer something removed from everyone. It's been brought down to us. The question is why? The question is, did the Hasidim ruin something by doing that? And has it gone too far? We're going to explore all of that. What is Kabbalah? Okay, basic working. Everything we're going to clarify as we go on with each week. We'll take it deeper and deeper. But just the basics and introductions today. What is Kabbalah? Kabbalah is the deeper teachings, sometimes called Chachma Sa'emes. Suggest is take a... Oh, we have a chair here still. Come. Welcome. Kabbalah is also sometimes known as Chachma Sa'emes, the wisdom of truth. It pertains to the realm of why. Torah doesn't deal with why. The why in the Torah is because I said so, Ki Ani Hashem, because I am Hashem, your God, or at most, because I took you out of Egypt. But really, why? What is it doing when I do this mitzvah? Why do I need to do all this? That's the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah comes from the word makabel, to receive. Vilna Gaon says you should view Kabbalah as part of our oral tradition. Just like Gemara is, so too Kabbalah. It's part of our oral tradition. The part is going to be, now the hard part is deciphering which is part of that tradition, which is part of that Mesorah, which is not. What I think this Kabbalah class is going to be unique is, besides the fact that I'm going to be dipping in history, spirituality, Parsha, a little bit of each as much as possible, I'm going to try to emphasize the Mesorah that's come to us through the Vilna Gaon. A lot of the New Age Kabbalah classes take a totally different route. They'll sit there meditating for an hour and a half. Yeah.
I want to detract.
No detraction. Go, please.
Sounds phenomenal, but just quickly, so what is it that this famous guy that sells the $500 books, I won't say his name, but you know what I'm talking about. What is it that...
So Kabbalah comes from the language of makabel, to receive. This is part of our tradition. This is all part of our tradition. Whoever missed the beginning few minutes, it's Kedai, someone repeat to you afterwards the story of the Zidit Shaver. Make a mark that you hear the story, because that, I think, is the essence of what's going on here. Just in a simplified way, the Zohar is similar to the Gemara. It's the mystical version of the Gemara. It flows like a Gemara. It feels like people think they're going to open a Zohar and see lights coming at them and long pauses to breathe and meditate. It operates almost like a Gemara, a give and take, almost like that of a Gemara. The Sefer Safra Ditzniusa, which we'll explore what that is, the Book of Hiddenness, that's very much like the Mishnah. It's bullet points, which needs further explanation, which the Zohar further explains. The writings of the Arizal, of which there are so many, he didn't write himself, his student wrote them, Rav Chaim Vital, we're going to get to as well. We're going to get full bios on everyone. We're going to get to know everyone. We're going to, God willing, get to know the style of the writings, see some of the writings inside, so you get an idea of who's who. The writings of the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, that's considered the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is what has all the laws, meaning it has all the bottom lines that you need to know. Okay, that's the triumvirate way of looking at it. That the Sefer Safra Ditznius is the Mishnah, the Zohar is the Gemara, the Kisvei Arizal is the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yitzchak Lur. All right.
I have another question.
Yes. Okay. Now, this thing which is called Kabbalah, which is also called Chachmas HaEmes, the wisdom of truth, is broken up into four categories. The four categories, you may have heard these terms before, Pshat, Drash, Remez, and Sod. This breakdown, which I'll define, is made famous by the Ramban, Nachmanides. Pshat, Drash, Remez, and Sod. By the way, I'm going to quote a lot of people. My point is to show you how the teachings of Kabbalah are so pervasive. They weren't reserved for a eclectic little group of Jews. They're Hasidim. They're Misnagdin, the Litvaks, like the Vilna Gaon. They're in our Gemaras. They're in our Rambans and our other thinkers. It's all over. Kabbalah's all over. It's not a little sect within Judaism. Chas v'shalom shenayim. So the four categories are Pshat, Drash, Remez, and Sod. Yes. Like it better. Good. Pardes, right? That's what it stands for. The orchard. The garden. Going
doesn't
deep
Kabbalah
in.
Kabbalah mean also to give over?
No, it means to receive. Kibbalah to receive.
Kabbalah. I meant... Like,
a tradition, a passed on tradition, a reception. It's the meaning of Vilna Gaon is part of our oral tradition.
Right.
Okay, it's a receiving. Okay, so what's Pshat? Pshat means the simple part of it. Meaning even within Kabbalah, there's the simple side of it. The basic simple side. One famous author who focuses on the simple side of Kabbalah is Rav Shalom Sharabi. I'll expose you to his writings, Moroccan scholar. The Remez side, where small allusions, hints to deeper ideas that, you know, it gives you just the top of the mountain and you have to discover the rest, that's the Vilna Gaon's world. You're stepping into the Vilna Gaon's world. Vilna Gaon claimed that his main area, his strongest area, is the area of Remez. We know how strong he is in the world of basic pshat and the psukim, what they mean, how many divrei Torah we have of the Vilna Gaon. For him to then claim that no, his strongest area was Remez, means that you could discover amazing worlds that we can't even fathom from the Ramazim, from the hints of the Vilna Gaon. Then there's Drash. Drash is when you derive and pull out. You begin to pull out Kabbalah. You begin to stretch out the Pshat and develop ideas that connect from one to another. That's the domain of the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who wrote the famous Mesilas Yesharim, the Paths of the Just. The great Musar work, we're going to look into some of his Musar Svarim, very heavy stuff, really, really very heavy stuff. I would never be able to touch even one iota of it if not for, thank God, so many great commentaries have come out in the last year, specifically this last year, that have made it accessible.
On the Ramchal?
On the Ramchal, on many other Kabbalistic Svarim.
What about Chobot HaLevavot?
There are some here and there Kabbalistic ideas, but it's basically a philosophy work. I put that in the realm of Jewish Machshava, Machshavat Yisrael. I'm in the realm of philosophy. I won't put in the realm of Kabbalah. So the last category is Sod in Pardes. Sod is the deepest secrets. Mm-hmm. That was the realm of the Baal Shem Tov, or where he felt where his realm was. To uncover Sod, the deep secrets of the Kabbalah, is the area of the Baal Shem Tov. This is an oversimplification, but I just wanted to give you someone who you could identify with each category, to give you a more association with each one. When Kabbalah became public for the first time, which is, I would say, around the beginning of the 12th and 13th centuries, these teachings of the Chachmas HaEmes became more widespread. Learned rabbis jumped on board. You have the Ramban, you have the Ravid, who's famous also for his commentaries on the Rambam. So you have Ravid, you have Ramban. They were known as being very committed to traditional ways of learning, traditional ways of observance, yet, and they were into Kabbalah. They weren't attacked as radicals. This never really was very controversial. It was as though it was always accepted and assumed to have been there. And when they made it more public for the first time, that was their thing. The early Kabbalists make their claim that their teachings come straight from Gan Eden, straight from the deepest parts of Gan Eden. We're going to talk about what that means, to have teachings that come from Gan Eden. But basically, it's a reference, forget the physical place Gan Eden, it's a reference to the fact that Kabbalah is the Torah in its purest form. It's Kabbalah in its form before it needs to interact with the limitations of this world. Many want to say the ideas of Kabbalah were always there all along, in the simple, out in the open, where you look at the whole strange story of the Maaseh Merkava, the chariot of Yechezkel, of Ezekiel, one of the hardest things to understand. The Gemara in Chagiga tells you that's biblical. That's not later Kabbalistic. That's biblical. The Talmud tells you that to understand that, you need to move mountains to be able to understand what's going on. That's Kabbalah. That's Chachmas HaEmes. That's the deeper teachings of the Torah. Again, don't associate Kabbalah with this image we have of this Sphira chart or meditation, or God forbid, the center. It's not that. Kabbalah's always been a pervasive part of our tradition. The Gemara tells us there were four who were nichnas into the pardes, who went deep into the orchard, so to speak, almost to the other side. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, and Rabbi Akiva. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, and Rabbi Akiva. As deep as we're going to go this year, we're not going to come close to anywhere near that they went to. But the result was Ben Azai looked inside the pardes and died. Ben Zoma glimpsed, the Talmud says, and he went mad. Acher, it says, cut the plants, which means he was totally detached from this world. He used to be a major Talmud Chacham, Elisha ben Abuya, but was lost to the world. He became an apikoros. Rabbi Akiva is the only one who came out in peace. These are all little introductory pieces that we're going to have to develop. What is this orchard that they entered into? What does it mean that Kabbalah comes from Gan Eden? What does it mean? What's the lessons that we're supposed to take away from Ezekiel, Yechezkel, and the Maaseh Merkava? What is that there? Okay. Why Kabbalah? Says the Arizal, very powerful line. The Arizal says, regular Torah, or Torah HaNigla, the revealed Torah, which we know of and is more famous, that comes from the world of the second tablets, the world that has been created as a result of the second tablets. Kabbalah, says the Arizal, is a product of the unshattered first tablets. Kabbalah is a product of the unshattered first tablets. Another way of making a distinction between them, what's the point of the Talmud? The Talmud shows you contradictions and then makes split. You know, it splits. It's called a chakira. It distinguishes between categories. That's what the Talmud's supposed to do. It tells you why some branches are good for a lulav and some are not. The purpose of the Talmud is to break things into multiple categories and classifications. That's the role of the Talmud. The role of the Kabbalah, says the Arizal, is here to unify, is to bring everything together. So the function of Kabbalah is totally different. It comes from a different place, whether it's Gan Eden, whether it's the first Luchos, or its function, and that's to unify as opposed to break down into raw components. It's there to bring everything back together. Why are we studying it now? Why now? Why all of a sudden now? Meaning we don't even know the base. That back then they had a tough time holding by the basics, right? Us, who barely know any of the basics, how many mitzvahs can we name, right? How many parshas can we name? How many of us can name every single letter in the Aleph base? It's not this right. Most of us can't name them. You go on an average shul, you can't name the entire Aleph base. But yet we're at Kabbalah. Why now?
Is it because of things happening in the world that are showing us that there's a some kind of something going on?
Something definitely shifted. The question is what? Did we shift or did the world shift? That's the question.
We need unification more than ever because we're so far away.
Our detachment. Okay. So one approach has been, because of our lower level, the open revealed Torah is not enough. Meaning, I'll say it like this. Someone who's very sharp and very smart, you give them the basics and they grasp the whole thing. Someone who is not as sharp or doesn't know as well, or doesn't get it, you have to give them the whole Megillah or else they're not going to chop. When you're talking to them, say in a relationship with someone who's a little bit thick. You're in someone thick, you're going to have to expel it out for them fully or else they're not going to get it. So that's one way. That's one way. Another way of looking at it is that, well, because of our lower level, we're misconstruing the outside. Not that we don't get it. Forget that we don't get it. Not that. What's being shown to us, we're perverting. We're perverting because we're not grasping it, and therefore God's like, all right, let me just show you what's going on over here fully so you don't misconstrue the stuff on the outside. The stuff on the outside is being explained in all the wrong ways, and therefore now in our generation, Kabbalah is being exposed. But these first two reasons, they don't really ennoble me to study. They tell me I'm a Shvach Jew, and because of it, fine, throw the dog a bone. Okay, I'll give you the third way. And this variation is probably, in my opinion, it's the second most important Hasidic story there is. The one I told you before is, in my opinion, the third most important Hasidic story. This, in my opinion, is the second most important Hasidic story. You may know this in one of its variations. The king had only one son. And that son took sick. And he went around to every single doctor all over the world. And he went from doctor to physician to physician to physician, and nothing doing. They couldn't figure it out. The kid was getting sicker. Nebuch was getting sicker. They couldn't get it. The king was so nervous. He was so sad. Finally, they heard there's one expert doctor that they could bring in. They could fly him in. They brought in this masterful doctor in, and he came and he took a look at the kid. And he nodded his head with sadness, and he said, there's nothing much you could do except for one thing, but it's out of your reach. There's a certain element, fricatine. You have to find this fricatine element and feed it to the kid. That's the only way. And we haven't seen it in years.
Is that a real word?
What? No. But you can put it whatever you want. It's one of the ingredients, I think, on the back of Coca-Cola. So you find it, you give it to the kid, and he'll be fine. So they're sitting there, basically about to sit Shiva, not knowing what to do. They're looking at each other, and the scientist, the chemist of the court, looks, and all of a sudden, when staring at the king, he realizes one of the jewels in the king's crown is made of this fricatine. And he's like, oh my gosh. He's like, Your Highness, the third jewel on the right is that element. It's that ingredient that the doctor was talking about. So the king says, we must grind it up and give it to my child. And everyone says, stop. You're getting ahead of yourself. This crown has been passed down to you from generation to generation. We're so careful with it. When you begin to run as our king, we stand around you with pillows out of fear the crown may drop. You're going to do this blasphemous thing, pull the jewel out of the crown, grind it up to give to the kid? And the king said, what value is my crown if I have no people to pass it on to? What value is my crown if I have no people to pass it on to? And that is why the Baal Shem Tov opened the gates. That's why the Baal Shem Tov made Judaism, its deeper teachings, its Kabbalah, its Chachmas HaEmes, its mystical side, accessible to the masses. The Baal Shem Tov said he did it because otherwise we would die without it. And think about where Hasidim came along. They came at a time, I would say, probably the worst period in the history of at least Judaism since the year 1000. Why? The circumstances were poverty was at its worst. Because of anti-Semitism, Jews were blocked out from any decent way of making a parnasa. That's number one. Number two, you just had the Khmelnytsky pogroms, which were probably the second or third worst Jewish tragedy in the history of Jewish tragedies, and we have no short list. Number three, besides that, you had the disbanding of the Vad Arba Artzos. The Vad Arba Artzos is the conference of the four groups of rabbis. They were not allowed to meet anymore. Number four, Jewish education was at its worst because they didn't have money. People couldn't afford to get a Jewish education, which meant you had this dichotomy. You had this religious elite, people like the Vilna Gaon, you had Nodeb Yehudas, people who were brilliant, who knew everything, but the masses knew nothing. And when the masses know nothing and you're relying on a few people who know everything, very hard to save that religion, especially with modernity waiting to hit, with the Enlightenment just waiting to creep up on the Jewish people. If only the elite knows Torah, it's over. With that backdrop is where Chassidus came alive. That's where the Baal Shem Tov... Oh, I forgot the fifth most important reason why the Baal Shem Tov emerged perfectly at that time was because how depressed the Jewish people were coming off the heels 100 years earlier of the Shabtai Tzvi movement. The false messiah. When he talked about the false messiah, let down 50% of Jewry, and he took 30%, or who knows, the numbers keep changing, how many Jews he took with him, Shabtai Tzvi. So really, the Baal Shem Tov could not have come at a more perfect time in Jewish history. It was perfectly planted by the Ribbono Shalom, perfectly planted at that time. Okay. Now, there's a big debate and a scholarly debate. People love talking about, everyone says the Zohar came from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, but modern scholars have shown us it has come from much later, and therefore it's nothing special. Let me clarify something. I think I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Zohar came much later than Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Number one, it has post-Talmudic language. It's quoting passages in the Talmud from Bava Basra. It's referring back. When you refer back to passages in the Talmud, it means you're post-Talmudic. Number two, it discusses concepts of Pshat, Remez, Drash, Sod, which only became public as a style of breaking up information with Nachmanides, right? Which was much later with Nachmanides. Number three, it has Ashkenazic style almost back and forth. And when it quotes texts of liturgy, it has Sephardic leanings, which means you have only very few communities in the history of Judaism where there was Sephardic liturgy with an infusion of Ashkenazi scholarship, which probably puts us where we believe somewhere in the late 1200s in Spain. That's where it puts us. That being said, this is just 2 minutes of 45, hours of documentation that shows the Zohar came much later. That being said, I do not think for a moment the Zohar is not a divinely influenced sefer. It entirely is. Like all books of the Kabbalah, it's a collection of the teachings of those that came before. It's a collection of the teachings of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who came before. That's our Masorah. The teachings in there, when the Zohar came out as a public book, it wasn't debated by the scholars and the leaders of Judaism. There wasn't this mass fight that broke out, and it's only 100 years later it got accepted. All sides of the Jewish camp accepted it, whether Hasidim with the Baal Shem Tov, whether the anti-Hasid, the Vilna Gaon. Look at his student. Everyone thinks the Vilna Gaon was anti-Kabbalah. It couldn't be further from the truth. You look at the works of his primary student, which we're going to explore as well, the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner. You look at the works of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and you see it's quoting Zohar left and right. Zohar all over the place. Of course they accepted the Zohar. And it's not a problem that it was written later. I'm happier it's written later. It gets to include more of the deeper teachings that happened along the way. A lot of the Sfarim, they say, was written, Sefer Yetzirah was written by Avraham. Was word for word of the Sefer Yetzirah written by Avraham? I don't know. Probably not. But it reflects a tradition that we have. These teachings come from Avraham. The Safar Tznusa, some say from Yitzchak, from Yaakov. We don't know when it was composed, actually. But it doesn't make a difference. It's part of a tradition, a canon, that was taught from teacher to scholar as part of our mystical tradition. It's fascinating to note that the Zohar and our Kabbalistic traditions have almost minimal debate. There aren't like major splits within the Kabbalistic world, what's accurate, what's not accurate. And therefore, that attests once again, just like the Torah, where there's very limited discrepancies between different Torah scrolls, right? Eight letter difference with the Yemenites, Temanim. All those years they were gone from the main in the mainstream Judaism, and they have 8 letters of difference between what we have in our Ashkenazi Torah scrolls, which is just wild. It's a wild thing to think about, and it testifies to this unity. Now, let's continue. Before we do a little more history, I told you I want to try to mix as much as possible history with something to say on the Parsha, with something to think about, Makshava, some deep teachings. I start with the opening words of the Zohar, and I'll read it out loud to you. I mean, I'll try from time to time to give you inside the Maor Makomos themselves. But I'll read you the opening words of the Zohar. Breshis bara Elokim. In the beginning, created God. God created. Amar Reb Shimon. Reb Shimon says, Tochazi, come and see. You can take a chair from the Yemenite show, I think.
Sorry, I thought I saw one over there.
Oh, no problem. Tochazi, come and see. That's, by the way, different than the Gemara. Anyone know what term the Gemara usually uses? What's the Gemara? Ta what? Anybody know? Toshma.
No,
come and listen.
No.
Come and listen. The Kabbalah uses Tochazi. Come and see. We're going to see why. There's deep teachings of that. Ba'araisa bara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Alma. God created the world with the Torah. V'ihu istakel bo zimna v'tarim v'tlasava arba zimnin. God looked in there 2, 3, and 4 times in the Torah, and then he created the world. We have to see what that means, that God looked in there 2, 3, and 4 times and then created the world. But let me just say this. The number 4 is a big number in Kabbalah. 10 is the biggest number. 10 is huge. Kabbalah loves 4. I'm going to show you that Kabbalah loves 4. There's something very perfect about the number 4, which we'll get into. So this teaching is a very deep teaching, that God looked into the Torah and created the world. What it means is that Torah is the cause and the world is the result. The Torah is the cause and the world is the result. Torah is the genetic code for this entire world. It's the DNA. It's the blueprint. God laid out the blueprint on the table. Istakel be'araisa, God looked in the Torah, ubore alma, and created the world. It's the blueprint for the entire world. It's the genetic code. It's the genetic code. Why is that important to know? That's the essence of kashrus. Everyone always says, why is something kosher or not kosher? So chas v'shalom, you explain to somebody else because it's unhealthy. That's wrong. It's the opposite. It's unhealthy because the Torah said you can't eat it. You understand? If someone tells you, why can't I eat treif? You can't say because it's unhealthy. We see. Look at you can look physically. It might be many of the foods could be healthy or not healthy. Comes the opposite, and we say that with the Torah, it tells you that it's unhealthy because the Torah says it is such. The Torah is the cause, and the world is the result. Torah is the cause, and the world is the result. I'll give you a story that illustrates this concept quite nicely. Someone once went to the Chazon Ish, and they asked for permission to leave Israel. They've never left Israel in their lives. They asked for permission to leave Israel. They have a certain heart condition that the only one who could operate on it is outside of Israel. Chazon Ish says, tell me about your condition. And he explains in detail the condition to the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish says, don't go. Stay here. This is wild. What do you mean, stay here? He says, I'll tell you why. The way you explain to me your condition, I'm very familiar with it in the context of animals in the Shulchan Aruch with the laws of what's called treifus. Treifus are when an animal has a certain blemish that considers it no longer kosher because it's not going to live anymore. So your condition, if that would be in an animal, is that a treifa or not? Well, in the Shulchan Aruch, it's a machlokas. According to the Shulchan Aruch, that animal's not a treifa. It's going to live. According to the Ramah, the Ashkenazic authority, that animal is a treifa. Said the Chazon Ish, outside of Israel, the ruling halachic decision is the domain of the Ramah. the Ashkenazic opinion. Inside the land of Israel, the ruling halachic opinion, the halachic domain, is that of the Sephardic opinion, that of Shulchan Aruch, Machaber, Maran HaMachaber. I'm telling you to stay, because if you stay in Israel, you'll be bound by the reality of the Shulchan Aruch and not the Ramah. Now, you take that story, and that's a strong illustration of this point, of the Chazon Ish taking what I said one step further. I, based on the Zohar, told you that the Torah is the genetic blueprint for the entire world. What it says goes. Comes the Chazon Ish and says not only that, but the oral law and the rabbinic teachings of later, they also create a certain reality. They create a certain and affect a certain reality. An example of where we see that is, let's say you have two kids that are born in a non-leap year, in a leap year. One, the first kid, the oldest kid, is born at the end of the first month, Adar Aleph, and the second kid is born at the beginning of Adar Bet. Suddenly, Bar Mitzvah year turns out it's one Adar that year, only one Adar. Whose Bar Mitzvah's first? The younger kid, because he was born on the second of Adar. How could he have the first Bar Mitzvah? He's younger. Says the Yerushalmi, because in the world of Halacha, he's older. He is older. You want to talk to me about chronologically, as far historically, chronologically, using secular concept of time? You're right. Halacha and Torah forms its own reality. And that's what the Zohar says. The Zohar says because the Torah, the world was created by Torah, it conforms to the reality of Torah. It conforms to the reality of Torah. And because of that, anything which is sheker, a deviation from Torah, anything which is false, sheker, cannot stand. It will fade away. Only truth can stand. Anything which is built on sheker, built on false, this is a basic premise of the Zohar. Anything which is built on something sheker, you build an entire world on sheker, it will crumble. It will crumble. You see how many great people who built a world, Mamish built an entire world, built an empire almost, and it all crumbles. If it's based on a sheker value, it cannot last. It cannot stand. As we know another Kabbalistic teaching, if you look at the letters of sheker, right, the bottom of a shin is rounded, the kuf has no base either, and the resh is just one little point. Each letter falls over. It has nothing to stand on. If you look at the letters of emes, truth, the aleph has two beautiful pegs to stand on, the mem, the bottom of the mem, has a beautiful platform to stand on, and the suf has beautiful platform to stand for. Truth stands. Sheker cannot stand. Look at where sheker is. Sheker is bunched to the middle three letters in a row. It doesn't have wings. It doesn't have space. Emes is the first letter of the Torah. It's the first letter of the alphabet, the middle letter of the alphabet, and it's the final letter of the alphabet. Aleph, mem, suf. It has space to be able to stand. It has space to be able to expand. That's what emes is, okay? Emes versus sheker. Truth versus that which is false. Okay? That's the difference. Yes?
I think it's a very beautiful idea that Hashem looked in the Torah and created the world, but isn't it anachronistic? Because the Torah describes the creation of the world and much that happened afterwards.
So what's your question? Say clear.
It's out of order. It's an anachronism.
No. God looks in the Torah and then creates a world, right? Creates a world. The beginning of Bereshis. Bereshis bara Elohim. Zohar says to do that, he had to first look in the Torah and make a world emerge. Day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, day 7. What's your question?
The Torah describes that it was done. In other words, the Torah is giving you the history of the creation of the world and the history of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov in the Midbar. So how could the
Excellent. How could the Torah be complete if nothing happened yet? We got to get to this topic. I'll give you just in a nutshell so I don't leave you hanging. The Maral understood that everything, God exists out of time. I'll use Maimonides' approach. This is easier. We have the problem of anachronistic because it says the whole storyline and we're looking afterwards. It's the same question of free will. How do we have free will if God wrote the script, if God knew the script beforehand, right? God knew the screenplay. How in the world do we have free will? So Maimonides' answer is that's a human problem. It's not a God problem. God exists in a realm where there is no before, present, and after. There's no such thing as time. The limitation of understanding how that can be only exists for a human being the problem only exists for a human being who exists within a concept of present, before, after. God, who exists in a realm that's not limited by time, could have a storyline that exists present, past, future, and pose no contradiction. So for time being, for argument's sake, we'll use Maimonides' God existing outside a world of time approach to be able to address your question. Yes, go ahead. One second.
With the kashrus, because it's not kosher, makes it unhealthy. Would that mean that for non-Jewish people, anything that's not kosher would at least not be unhealthy?
I don't think so. At least not within the Tanya's teachings. The Tanya's going to show you how for it's unhealthy for us because God. It's exactly this logic. Because God commands it to us, it makes it unhealthy for us.
Yeah, but a Jew is not us, and the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noah, they are not commanded not to eat. Not kosher.
Right. Meaning, so, who is commanded not to eat not kosher? Just the Jews.
Just the Jews. So I would think that non-Jews, it wouldn't be unhealthy.
Right, I agree.
Oh, you do agree.
I agree, 100%. Oh, okay. I agree. Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Oh, okay. I would think, according to what we're saying, since God did not command it to the non-Jews, it's not unhealthy. Where this comes up is always the famous issue, how back to its healthy place. Okay. There's so much we could do here. I'm trying to think what... Let me give you a couple more historical pieces, then maybe I can close with something on... maybe you could delve a little bit into Noach to give us something about Parshas Noach. Yes, please.
With Eve and Adam and the apple, just using that as an example, how much of that is Kabbalah? How much of that is Torah that we normally learn? We sometimes learn that the apple wasn't an apple, it was wheat, it was this other whatever.
You'd have to study the section at length to know which is... what's it called? You have to study the section at length to know which is the Talmudic stuff, which is the Midrashim, which is the Kabbalah. That would take us a while to map out which is which comes from the Kabbalah. But if you were to get the beginning of the Zohar, and they have translations, they have very good translations out of the Zohar, you would see quite clearly what's there at the beginning, which part is coming from the Kabbalah, which part is not. Then you'd have to decipher which is Talmudic. But you could figure out just by looking at the Torah which one is the Torah. That's easy. That you just have to look at the Chumash inside. But you'd have to decipher the whole the Zohar. You have very good translations of the Zohar that are out now. Okay, you know, let's do a little bit on Noach. This is very Kabbalistic stuff. And if you missed everything until now, or you were in and out, at least you get something on the Parsha here. It says, Eile told us Noach, Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorasav. These are the generations of Noach. Noach was a tzadik. He was tamim, he was wholesome in his generation. Eta Elokim hitalech Noach. God walked with Noach, or Noach walked with God. Vayoled Noach shlosh banim. And Noach gave birth to three children, Shem, Cham, and Yafas. Right? Shem, Cham, and Yafas. Here we go. Zohar. Shloshat b'nei Noach. The three children of Noach were Shem, Cham, and Yafas. The Rosh Tevas of which are Shin, Yud, Ches, right? Shem, Cham is Chet, Yaf is Yud. Siach, which means to talk. The three children of Noach are Siach. As it says, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basada. Isaac went out to speak in the field. What does it mean he was speaking in the field? What was he doing? What's Lasuach mean? What do you mean?
Davin.
Davin. He went to go talk in the field. Sicha is a lashon of tefillah. So follow very carefully. We're getting heavy Kabbalah now. Hatoldas shel Noach im kein hayu sicha. What then was the derivative of Noach? It says Noach produced three children. Shem, Cham, and Yafes. If they're Rashi Tevos, the Rashi Tevos are the essence. They're the beginning. They're the beginning point. That's the Rashi Tevos. The first letter is the beginning point where everything starts from. If my name is Shlomo, the Shin is my beginning point. That's where it all starts from. Okay, that's why Rashi Tevos is significant. Oh, why are you taking Rashi Tevos, first letters? Because it's your beginning point. It defines you. That's why Rashi Tevos is significant. So if you take the Rashi Tevos of Shem, Cham, and Yafes, you get Siach, which is prayer. It's one of the languages of prayer. So what does it mean? Noach gave birth to prayer. Noach gave birth to prayer. So now he says... Milashin tefila, hatolda shel Noach is sicha, which is tefila. Tefila is a language of naftuli elokin naftalti. What is naftuli elokim naftalti? It means like I got unraveled. Tefillah, when you're all stuck in a bind, when all your ropes are tangled, so to speak, your world is a mess. Tefillah is what you use to untangle the whole cord. Okay, tefillah is used to untangle the whole cord. Okay. Now he goes back to the pasuk. Eile told us Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. Eile told us Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. Let's put this together. So Rashi says in that. Hoyel vihiskiro sipar b'shivcho shenemar zecher tzaddik levracha. Since it mentioned him, it gave a little praise. Just like we say zecher tzaddik levracha, when we mention someone. We're mentioning them, we might as well say zecher, remember that righteous for blessing. Or another opinion says, why does it say these are the generations of Noach? Meaning, why does it say these are the generations of Noach? Noach was a tzaddik. So one opinion is, while it mentions him, might as well mention a little praise. Right? There is Noach was a tzaddik. Second opinion says no. Lilamdecha she'ikar toldoseim shel tzaddikim maisa tovim. It says these are the generations of Noach. These are the derivatives, the offshoots of Noach. What's the main offshoot of a person? Noach ish tzaddik. The second opinion of Rashi, by the way, is Kabbalistic. No one stopped to ask, maybe that's Kabbalah. That's a Kabbalistic idea. That's a very deep and heavy idea. The concept that what the Torah is telling you, by these are the generations of Noach, Noach was a tzaddik, meaning what's bothering Rashi. You understand what's bothering Rashi? You always have to ask what's bothering Rashi. What's bothering Rashi is why didn't it go straight to the kids? It says these are the generations of Noach. Noach was a tzaddik, and these are his kids. Go straight to the kids.
And the use of the word ish.
And ish.
Why
do you
have to tell us that he's a man?
Well, you know you're right. Good. So that's what's bothering Rashi. So the first opinion says, no, it's getting to the kids. Slow down. It just wants to give him a nice name. Noach who? Noach the tzaddik. These are his kids. The second opinion of Rashi is deep. The second opinion of Rashi is saying, no, these are the generations of Noach. Yeah, kids are generations. But that's not really what's generations of a person. What's really generations of a person is the good deeds you do in this world. The maisim tovim. Noach ish tzaddik. That's his toldos. Those are his toldos. At the end of the day, someone could have a kid who's terrible. I mean, no one could predict that. What the value of the next generation is the good deeds that you do in this world. The tova that you do with another person. The good deed that you do to help another person. That's your toldos. That's your ripple effect. That's your future generations. So we see there are two types of toldos. Two types of generations, derivatives. Yesh told us the gashmias. There are derivatives in the physical sense, right? Like children or something like that. Or there are told us the ruchnias. There are spiritual derivatives. And Rashi's telling you which one of those is the primary and important derivative in this world. The primary and important derivative in this world, Iker told us same shel tzadikim, is the maisim tovim. Your main derivative in this world as a human being is the good that you do in this world. That's it. That's your main contribution. The good you do, they're both called toldos, but the main one, says Rashi, is the good you do in this world. So, lefizeh pashut ubar hadavar. Therefore, according to that, it seems simple and clear. Shehamahut apnimit shel toldos, hein toldos agashmim, atoldos aruchnem, shavazu azu. Ukeshem shebatoldos agashmim, shem chamiyaz v'chein esicha, kech gam tos shem, lech yitzar, toldos shem maisim tovim shelo, I just read through that paragraph fast because I have no clue what it meant. I'll read it again. We're going to have a lot of that on this run. Read it again. Lefizeh pashut ubar hadavar. According to that, it seems simple and clear. Shahamahut hapnimit shalatolos. The inner essence of generations. There are physical derivatives and there are spiritual derivatives. And on one sense, they're equivalent. Just like there are physical derivatives. Who are they here? Shem, Cham, and Yafes. They are, you take the Rashi Tevos, they are a prayer. They are a prayer. Ah, I got it now. I got it now. I got what he's doing. Okay. What's a prayer? A prayer is a way in which we connect to God. A prayer is a way in which we connect to God.
Brings us closer,
right? Dveikus. It's the devik. It's the glue. You see Rabbi Abraham Tversky's book on prayer. It's a beautiful book on prayer. Right at the beginning, he uses the idea of prayer as a glue. It's our glue. just like Noach's production of his children, created an inner spiritual reality in the world called tefillah, prayer. Why? Because we said the first letter of each word is siach, is to speak, is to tell a prayer, is prayer. So too, on the spiritual side, what was his spiritual derivative? His maisim tovim. It means that the maisim tovim, your actions, also must manifest that concept of prayer. What's the concept of prayer? What's the chap of prayer? The chap of prayer is that it's the great glue. It's what binds you to God. It's what binds you to God. Meaning, if his physical derivatives are going to be explained in the way on a deeper level of tefillah, then the spiritual derivative of Noach, which we already said is what? Is his maisim tovim, is his good deeds, is going to manifest itself in the same way as a prayer, as a tefillah, which means his good deeds are a form of a connection, are a form of connection. They're a form of clinging. And that's why it says in the Gemara, V'lulei shiyispal adam koyim kol. We wish that someone could pray all day long. Halavai. Halavai that someone could pray all day long. That power of prayer is that unbelievable. So why pray? Remember, I said at the beginning, the Kabbalah is here to explain why. Why pray? God asked you to pray. Your forefathers said pray. That's why you pray. That's before we learn Kabbalah. When you begin to learn Kabbalah, you understand why pray?
Glue.
It's your connection. It's your connection. I'll tell you such a deep idea from Rav Kook. Rav Kook was so deep into Kabbalah, so head deep into the Chachma Sa'emes. You use this understanding of prayer, it'll change your tefillah, I'm telling you now. Rav Kook says everybody thinks that what's prayer? Prayer is when I'm ready to open up, finally I bring forth a new light. I bring forth, he says, that's wrong. It's not what prayer is. Prayer is going on 24/7 inside of you. It's happening all day, nonstop. It's when you could stop and finally open up that part of your soul and let the prayer burst out. That's what tefillah is. That's what tefillah is. Meaning prayer, tefillah is going on all day. Our job is, though, to open up our souls so that it could, that light that's fighting to come out, that's praying all day, whatever that means, it's active all day trying to connect to God. Use this glue idea. It's trying all day to connect to God. It waits for you to get to a shachris, a mincha, a marv, or a time when you just stop and you burst out in prayer openly to God. It waits for that light to just come shooting out. That's why, what's the word for when someone says, right? If anyone was in yeshiva in younger years, If you were like not focusing, you're daydreaming, right? The teacher says, "Where's your kavana? Where's your kavana?" What does kavana mean? Kavana means like, where's your intent, right? Where are you thinking about this, or are you thinking about the ball game? That's kavana. Says Rav Kook, that's too simple. You know what kavana is? What does the word kavana mean in Hebrew? It comes from kivun. Kivun. What's kivun?
Direction.
What are you putting? What direction? It's taking that energy that's praying inside of you, that light that's waiting to burst forth inside of you, and turning it in the right direction. It's you know what it's like? Imagine those things that are the kosher lamp. Anybody see the kosher lamp?
Yeah.
Kosher lamp is a light, but it has a shield around it that, this is why maybe there's an idea in the Kabbalah I'm going to share with you later, that everything in this world is here to teach us a deeper idea. So I couldn't figure out what the deeper idea of the kosher lamp was until now. The kosher lamp is this light, right? But it's covered by a shield. But the light is still active whether or not you see it. Even if you don't see the light, it's active. It's just waiting for you to turn the open part of the shield to the kivun, the right direction, so that the light could come forward. That's Rav Kook's concept of tefillah. We were given kosher lamp in this world to understand Rav Kook's concept of tefillah, to understand that it's turning around that open window that allows prayer to burst forth and then connect us to everyone else in this world. Okay, to make us a part of everyone else in this world. Okay, we stop here with our first Kabbalah shir. We continue God willing next Monday night. We'll have more history, more Kabbalah, more Parsha, all wrapped into one.
Can we
sure.